Across the world, trans people face high rates of deadly violence, catastrophic suicide rates, and frequent exclusion from public life. The Transgender Murder Monitor, an international register, records 3,317 trans people who have been murdered in the past decade. Trans people 18 years and over are nearly 11 times more likely to attempt suicide than the general population. And the difficulties people face in transitioning are made worse by hostile media campaigns, hostility from some feminists, and a lack of specific workplace rights and protections. But trans people and their allies are far from passive. They are organising and they are resisting. At the University of Melbourne earlier this year, more than 1,000 people signed an open letter to the university condemning a transphobic website published by an associate professor, and hundreds marched across the campus. And as we'll hear, union activists are on the cusp of winning transition leave provisions at the University of Sydney. Today I'm talking about the issues with Danny Cotton. Danny is a member of the National Tertiary Education Union, an activist with the NTEU Casuals Caucus at the University of Sydney, and a member of Solidarity. You're listening to The Sound of Solidarity, brought to you by Solidarity, a revolutionary socialist group in Australia. If you'd like to find out more about us, our website is solidarity.net.au. I'm David Glanz, and I'm recording this episode on unceded Wurundjeri land in Naam, or Melbourne. Danny, welcome.
Thanks so much, David. It's great to be here. I'm coming in from Gadigal country here in Sydney.
Fantastic. First up, can you paint us a broad picture of the issues facing trans people in Australia today?
Trans people face serious exclusion from whole elements of kind of social life and economic life. So to give you a bit of an idea, in Australia, about 1 in 5 young trans people have experienced homelessness. And to give an idea of employment, there's been a number of kind of international surveys that give an idea. So a New York survey found that 49% of trans people had never been offered a job while living as trans. And a survey in the United Kingdom of employers said that 1 in 3 employers openly admitted that they were less likely to hire a transgender person, and only 24% said that they remained unsure. So only 4% said that their workplace was diverse enough that a transgender person would fit in if hired. So these statistics, I think, paint a bit of a picture of what it's like, you know, as a trans person when you're doing anything that anyone else would have to do, you know, going to, you know, job interviews and trying to get past the interview stage with a lot of oppressive ideas in people's heads about what trans people are necessarily like, that they're a bit of a problem and things like this. So kind of from housing and employment, as well as kind of the issues that people continue to face in terms of just accessing medical costs and going through processes of transitioning and the strained relationships and personal relationships that that process can give. So I guess, you know, there is a lot of social oppression that trans people are facing, and trans people have a lot of reasons to fight back.
Some of the things you've just described are very current, and trans liberation is a relatively new political movement which has really arisen to challenge some of that oppression. But the existence of gender variant people across place, time and culture is not a new thing. So have gender variant people always met hostility?
Well, you're right that gender variance is not a new thing. We know from kind of long histories of pre-class and pre-capitalist societies in which trans people didn't face the same kind of discrimination. I mean, I guess even using the word trans is quite a recent phenomenon. In previous times, it was just people just had various genders. So to give, you know, a couple of the ideas, you know, we know of third genders that exist, for example, in India with the Hijra for many, many years, and in Turtle Island or across America, that there were many, many various ways in which people expressed their genders, with as many as 5 different genders. And that's kind of been grouped in a pan-Indian movement of, has called this like two-spirit people, to kind of grasp that before capitalism, these forms of gender variance, and before colonization, that these forms of gender variance were not kind of looked upon as necessarily problematic, but rather just part of normal social life. And I guess, you know, even in our region, you know, like the Fafafine people, third genders exist in a whole number of different ways. But over time, particularly with the development of colonization and capitalism, there were kind of very strict binaries that began to be overlaid onto that. And we have kind of quotes from all of these colonists who talk about how shocked they were at the quote primitives and their gender variant ways and their admittance of kind of homosexuality and these kinds of things. You mentioned that trans liberation is relatively new. So from those times of gender variance, I think trans identity has really changed. I mean, after the German Revolution in the 1920s was the first time that we saw kind of trans surgeries and the ideas of kind of medical changes being associated with gender variance. That only really became possible in the 1920s and with not only technology, but with a political spirit of people willing to challenge and question these kinds of things. And the gay liberation movement, which kind of started, you know, from the late 60s, early 70s across the world, and particularly in America, was from the start very, very entrenched with gender variant people. Now, you know, they might not go by trans, but there's an old saying, who threw the first stone at Stonewall, talking about the role of black trans women in starting that revolt. But even more recently, we've seen kind of more of an explicitly kind of trans liberation movement that, you know, has brought a lot of energy and fight, and hopefully we can talk about that some more.
As Marxists, we know that oppression is shaped and nurtured by capitalist society, and our rulers want to fragment the working class. So how does transphobia fit into that scenario, given that people who identify as trans are a very small number of people in society compared to the overall population? Why does capitalism benefit from oppressing trans people?
It's a great question. I mean, I think we should start off that conversation by talking about sexism and the nuclear family, because I think that's really where transphobia ultimately originates. I mean, it's the nuclear family that enforces a strict binary of men and women and a distinct set of social roles that those people are supposed to perform. We're told, you know, that men are strong breadwinners and women are soft, caring nurturers who stay at home and look after the children, do all of that domestic work to keep the family going and the caring work and et cetera. And these stereotypes are obviously continue to shape us, not only from when we're born and grow up and from the media, which replicates a lot of these ideas, and even our engagement with all forms of society, where we see huge gender segregation of the workforce, where women predominantly take on poorly paid roles in aged care, early childhood education, while men are, you know, disproportionately represented in construction and these kinds of roles. So we have this ongoing replication across capitalism of this gender binary. And it's my view that doesn't benefit anyone. Like, it certainly doesn't benefit transgender people who feel that they don't fit into the role that's been assigned to them at all, and that maybe they identify with a different role altogether. But I don't think it works for cisgender people either, at least not many that I've ever spoken to. And by cisgender, I mean people who aren't transgender, who do identify with the gender that they were assigned at birth. So I think that overall picture kind of sets the scene. Over time, we've also seen, I mean, you mentioned, you know, trans people are a very, very small percentage of the population, but you wouldn't guess it for how much that they seem to talk about trans people. And by they, I mean, you know, the Liberal Party, I mean, the Australian newspaper. Trans people continue to, for them, I guess, play a bit of a divide and rule function. And by that, I mean that trans people are an easy wedge to focus on and say, look at this problem. The Greens and the Labor Party, they want to fight for trans people. They want, you know, gender to be wiped out. They're crazy. Not like us. We're gonna defend you. And whipping up a moral scare and panic about trans children and trans people in bathrooms and so on, which is a fair feat. Like, there's no evidence of that happening at any serious percentage of the population and so on. But for them, it continues to play a role to kind of distract from the real issues that people are facing and pretend that instead of your enemy being your boss, the Liberal Party, who are trying to push through whole new legislative framework that attack working class people, But instead of that, we're meant to believe that a tiny percentage of trans people are the people that we should be worrying about. I mean, to me, it's by dividing trans people off from the working class movement, not only that contributes to oppression, but also pulls us away from the forces that we need to challenge, you know, oppression and the society we live under.
You mentioned the Australian and other right wingers. In the last few years, we've seen some serious attempts to whip up moral panic around so-called gender whisperers, the Safe Schools programme, which came in for a ferocious series of attacks. And then there was the transphobia of the No campaign during the equal marriage plebiscite. So who's driving those campaigns and what's the impact on trans people?
We're told that the perpetrators of anti-trans action and anti-trans behaviours are really predominantly poor people who don't understand, don't have the education. But what you just described and what we've seen over the last few years has been attacks from a very wealthy and very well-educated minority of society who are happy to kind of basically bash trans people in their words. The Australian gender section of their newspaper that's dedicated to attacking trans people spread kind of a ferocious anti-trans agenda. And the role of the Liberal National Party in this has been huge, and I think continues to be huge. I mean, a lot of the time on the very front lines, it's the hard right of the Liberals and the One Nation who are pushing, you know, the parental rights bill or, you know, speaking about the gender whisperers as ScoMo, But the reality is that I think it's driven by a Liberal Party who sees that it is in its interest to continue to spread these hate campaigns.
And what impact have they had on trans people?
You mentioned before that anti-trans attacks have gone up, particularly across countries like the UK and America, and we've also seen increases in Australia. The reality is when you have such a push from the ruling class, from the Liberal Party, from the media, from kind of the organised transphobic movement, it legitimises the position of transphobia and spruiks up a fear in people and turns it into a hot button issue that then people have to face, you know, whether you're walking down the street or on a dating app or whatever it might be. I think it has a hugely harmful impact. I mean, we know that transphobia is not just a forever impact that has just always existed and always will exist. We talked before about that it's quite a modern phenomenon, but similarly today it goes up and down with the tides, and with these increasing attacks, I think it has created a more hostile environment and a backlash that trans people have been facing kind of in their day-to-day.
Yes, and some listeners will be thinking, well, who cares about The Australian with all its reactionary filth? Because who reads The Australian? And it does have a small circulation. But I've written about this in Solidarity magazine in the past, about the way in which The Australian has a very specific role in emphasising and amplifying reactionary ideas amongst politicians and the political class. So it may not be read widely in your suburb or my suburb, but it's read very widely in Canberra, in state parliaments. The arguments are picked up by Sky After Dark, which then amplify those reactionary arguments, not just on TV, but then through their Facebook and other social media channels, and creates a situation where it both puts pressure on politicians to move to the right, but also makes them feel that that's what everybody's thinking and legitimizes their more reactionary positions. So there is a real, it's not even an echo chamber, it's an amplification process going on where a paper like The Australian plays a disproportionate role. So as you say, this is a very deliberate driving of an agenda from the top of society. Moving on the face of it, feminists and trans activists should be natural allies, together against oppression, challenging what is supposedly the normality of the nuclear family, as you outlined earlier. But as we know, there's a section of the feminist movement that is fiercely hostile to trans rights, particularly the rights of trans women. Talk us through this contradiction.
Yeah, this has been a difficult issue, particularly over the last, you know, few years, but for decades. I think I want to draw a line between the role of kind of organized feminists and organized transphobic feminists and ordinary women. Now, like, and ordinary people, ordinary men and women, ordinary gender diverse people, where I think that a lot of people have transphobic ideas. I mean, we've just talked about the predominance of the biases that we see in the media and the ideas that we're fed through that and that percolate through society. It should be no surprise to us that those kind of oppressive ruling class ideas, just like racism, just like sexism, that transphobia is expressed by people everywhere. And I think it's, you know, our job as socialists and progressives to talk people through these ideas, challenge them when we hear them, and try to show that the fight for trans rights is really connected to the fight for working class rights and the fights against sexism and so on. I think it's a little different when we're talking about kind of organized transphobic feminism. This is something that, to my view, is kind of often a middle class phenomenon. For example, at the universities, we see a huge issue with kind of a minority of transphobic feminists who really see trans people and particularly trans women as a threat to them, potentially a threat to their kind of papers and their little academic turf. In this specific instance, but we also see it in other elements of the more institutionalized women's movement, maybe people who unfortunately operate refuges and things like this, who have their little stake of funding, and that they see trans women as a bit of a threat, as opposed to for ordinary people. I think trans people are, you know, someone who they probably haven't met and don't know that much about. So that fierce hostility, I guess, has created a situation in which there's been really awful allies formed between transphobic feminists, things like the Australian newspaper and the media and Sky News and all of this, alongside the Liberal Party and the organised right wing of politics. So a good example is what we saw in University of Melbourne in the last years, when the Victorian Labor Dan Andrews government pushed through birth certificate reform, which, for people who might not know, birth certificate reform is about ensuring that people's birth certificates can reflect their true gender. The reason this is important is because it can be kind of bizarre when you're someone who's maybe presenting as a man and you try to show your documentation, and then your documentation says that you're a woman. It means outing yourself over and over again. It means people being a bit confused, misgendering you, sending you to the wrong place, blah, blah, blah. This happens all the time. And having your legal documents just reflect the gender that you are and that you are socially, rather than what you were designated at birth, is just from my perspective, just a simple right and something that we absolutely need to change. In New South Wales, for example, you're required to have genital surgeries before you're able to do that, which can cost upwards of $30,000. It's an invasive surgery that people shouldn't be forced to have. I guess there's a movement towards self-identification where you can just get that change to reflect your identity. So the Andrews government pushed through this reform, but the backlash to that was a bunch of kind of transphobic stereotypes. They called them men dressed as women, invading women's bathrooms, and so on, as if the main threat to women are people pretending to be transgender in order to get into women's bathrooms, when we know that that's not where the majority of abuse happens. That's a serious issue that needs to be fought rather than kind of turn into a furphy about trans people. So there was a forum, I guess, at University of Melbourne that drew together transphobic feminists like Holly Lawford-Smith behind the Victorian Liberal Party's right-wing agenda, attacking the Labor Party and trying to score some opportunistic points. So I think that shows you a little example of something that we have seen all around Australia. There's a little group called the Feminist Legal Clinic, for example, in Sydney, who, you know, predominantly is focused on anti-trans campaigning rather than fighting for women's rights, which is a real shame because we're in dire need of feminists and a feminist legal clinic of people fighting for women's rights when it comes to parental rights and working rights and everywhere. I think that shows a bit of a picture of, you know, of the problems that can happen when I guess a small minority of transphobic feminists kind of choose to ally with the right wing side of things. And my view as a socialist, we should really have no truck with that kind of behaviour. Fighting for progressive campaigns, you know, alongside women with all sorts of ideas and all sorts of political backgrounds. That's what trans people should be doing, fighting together for the kinds of reforms that would benefit all of us, rather than worrying about, you know, a minority of people who choose to side with the Liberal Party and the right wing.
One of the arguments that those transphobic feminists use is that there's now been several waves of campaigning for women's liberation, and that if people can choose to become a woman, this undermines the entire idea that there is, that women have something to fight for or to defend. I mean, I think it's a nonsense argument, but how do you respond?
I think that plays into kind of a dangerous and a sexist vision of what it is to be a woman. For quite some time, like the idea that there's some biological essential nature to what women are, this is used again and again by the right wing. They want to say that, you know, use some spurious academic studies that supposedly show that there's a gene for why women are more meek, and they get poorer paid jobs because they're actually it's just in their DNA to be more caring and blah blah blah. I mean, we could talk for hours about these kinds of what I think are deeply sexist visions that to my mind, all share an understanding that what it is to be a woman is essentially some kind of biological reality. I think as socialists and as progressives, that we should see the nature of gender as coming from the nuclear family. And this is something that has a long history. I mean, Engels' famous book about the origins of the state and the origins of sexism is still worth a read today. But, you know, I think for materialists, we see sexism as originating from the socially produced nature of gender that occurs under the nuclear family and that form of differentiation. I mean, we talked about this a little bit at the start, but to my mind, materialists should understand that social reality of gender is where all of this oppression comes from. Now, is there a relationship to biology and sex? Absolutely. I mean, we've seen things about abortion campaigning, such an important issue for women and such an issue of sexism. But I think it's another clear area where trans people, particularly trans men who need abortion rights, many gender diverse people need abortion rights themselves, and trans women who see the kind of sexist ideas that get pushed by anti-abortion campaigns. To me, it's a clear area of unity around a biological issue. Is that gendered? Absolutely. Is biology and gender related? Absolutely. But to reduce, I guess, gender to the nature of sex and to our genes and these kinds of things, to me, simply plays into the arguments of the right, when what we should be doing is kind of coming up with an analysis that understands the social production of gendered relationships and sexism and how we can fundamentally challenge that, of which there are millions of ways. I mean, I'm of the belief we should smash apart the nuclear family, give free abortions to anyone who needs them, socialize housing, socialize all of the domestic sphere, and not leave that to be done predominantly by women. And I think that's something that all people of all genders or no gender can get behind.
Okay, we're moving on to talking about alternatives to and resistance to this system of oppression. I mentioned in my introduction that there is organizing and there is resistance amongst trans people and their allies. Tell us about what that looks like.
Well, I've been active in the kind of the trans movement here in Sydney for many years. And I think there's been a huge pickup in the degree to which trans rights are seen as a heart of political activism. I mean, we've seen increasingly regular rallies of, you know, called on the days of Trans Day of Resistance, Trans Day of Remembrance, Trans Day of Visibility, regular protests here in Newtown that give an opportunity for trans people to stand up and march in pride and in celebration, but also, you know, quite consciously, there's been huge debates about the demands that we need to take to those and why we need to be challenging the state institutions that perpetuate oppression and also fight back the bills from the right. Those have turned into a regular protest campaign, and people have probably seen some of the incredible campaigning against right-wing agenda. There's been a few bills pushed by One Nation around parental rights and religious freedom. And those protests have thus far been very successful. I mean, 2 or 3 years ago, end of 2018, I think, Scott Morrison was talking about gender whisperers and pushing for a religious freedoms bill. And we have never seen that come to fruition. And I think a large part of that is that there has been a huge backlash from trans people, but from all people, from the LGBT movement, from women's groups, from society at large, opposing that and showing that rather than this being an opportunity for the Liberals to gain some votes by bashing trans people and trying to perpetuate transphobia, actually this could be a vote loser for them. And they've been a bit scared to do it. Politically, the influence of this, I think, has been absolutely huge and has really added kind of a sense of kind of political confidence in trans people. But most recently, there's been some like interesting developments that are worth talking about. I mean, just last year, we actually had a poll. It was kind of the last women's poll, put out a transphobic ruling that said that trans people would not be allowed to enter unless they had undergone surgery. Bottom surgery. And the idea that trans people have to jump through those kinds of hoops or that women are fundamentally threatened by people with penises, I think is problematic. It also undercuts the fact that people who haven't undergone bottom surgery, trans women, have been using those baths for many, many years without, you know, and there's elements of the Coogee women's groups who have been very, very supportive of trans rights, and it's been a beautiful thing. So when we heard about this, we actually organised a bit of a protest swim-in, which was a kind of over 100 people came along to protest that decision. A local Coogee women's group came out in support and occupied the pool for us. And then trans women went down and actually broke that rule, and it's since been withdrawn. And those kinds of little elements of contestation and pushing back have been really good. And I know at the moment there's a lot of discussion. We're really hoping to get a bit of a push on trans birth certificate reform. One other thing that's worth speaking about is that right now there's a petition demanding that trans healthcare get included on Medicare. And it's gone over 140,000 signatures, near 150,000, which is very significant for that many people to put their name behind, you know, a demand that trans people be supported in transition and that transition be a state right that is supported. This is just painting, I guess, some of the contours. It's obviously been very difficult to mobilise during the coronavirus pandemic. But nonetheless, I think there has been an increasing confidence to fight and contest transphobia by trans people and also by all people. I mean, for me, some of the strongest points of, you know, of this swim-in was actually the Coogee Beach afterwards, where men, women, transgender diverse people, old and young, were kind of just swimming at the beach together. And I know that can seem like a small thing probably to people, but it actually, for a lot of people, that was, they said that was kind of the first time that ever been out at the beach, or that they felt confident to kind of do that, given how deeply ingrained transphobic ideas are. And I think I draw a lot of hope at some of these increasing campaigns and the increasing unity we're seeing of people behind trans rights, and seeing that trans rights, LGBT rights, women's rights are actually all linked in as part of one struggle.
And that takes us, I think, very neatly to my last question. If trans rights are linked to women's rights, they're also absolutely linked to workers' rights as well. And there's a really exciting development in which you've been centrally involved, and that's the campaign to win paid transition leave as part of enterprise bargaining negotiations at the University of Sydney. And for those who don't know the university sector, the University of Sydney has traditionally been the pace setter on conditions, and what's won at the University of Sydney has a habit, if people mobilise, of spreading through the university sector over the coming rounds of enterprise bargaining. So tell us about that campaign. Tell us about, was there any resistance amongst your workmates? Was there any reluctance? How did the university respond? This seems like a really historic breakthrough. So take us through it.
It is really exciting. Yeah, we're in the midst of a huge fight at Sydney University, and one that I'm really excited about. So it started with a bit of a simple open letter to the union asking for a form of gender transition leave that we felt would reflect the nature of transition. So we just said that calling for 6 weeks of leave would allow for people to undergo the forms of transition that are so often neglected. Now, 6 weeks might seem a lot like a long time to a lot of people, but for trans people who might decide to kind of undergo surgeries, I mean, it's, you know, it's some trans people see that as part of their journey, others don't. It's not something that I think that the university should have any role in saying what's okay and what's not okay. And so I think it's just important that that leave allows trans people to undergo whatever form of transition that they might have, you know, from legally changing their documents. You know, I can tell you it's a fight with the administration when you want to change your name or anything like that. It's not easy, let alone kind of dealing with, you know, medical system. I've just talked about, you know, how expensive it is, how trans people often will save up for years or you know, want to come out and just be waiting and waiting and waiting until they can afford it, save up the leave, save up the money so that they can kind of undergo expensive surgeries and these kinds of things. And we know that kind of closeting your identity and keeping hidden like that and can have a huge impact. Now, I've talked a bit about like the time of transition, I think is really important for trans people. It's often a time of kind of intensified oppression, and it's a time in which you might have strained personal relationships, you may have a strained job, you may have to leave your job, you may be scared to come out at work, you might leave the formal economy altogether. I mean, a lot of people leave their job and then find it very difficult to make their way back into the economy, particularly while living as trans. And there's a huge number of trans people for whom sex work is their only option. And I just think trans people should have every option, you know, and fighting for trans people to be able to stay at work is utterly essential. It should be a right for trans people to be supported by the employer to stay in work and say that we support your transition journey and we support you to stay employed with our workplace. And, you know, 6 weeks is a lot for that trans person, and it makes a huge difference to be supported to stay at work. I mean, I can't imagine what a difference this would make if this was across society to trans people everywhere, that the transitioning was a right and not a privilege. But for the university, I mean, we're talking about $1 billion institution, and a tiny percentage of staff are trans, partly due to the barriers that I spoke about before. And a tiny minority of those are really likely to take large amounts of leave. So it's quite a cheap for the university in the context of things for them to do this. Despite that, there has been a bit of kickback. There's kind of a union of sorts, in inverted commas, of the employers, of the university bosses. And the executive of that, Stuart Pill, said that transition leave was an ambit claim. He said that it was way beyond community expectations, and he called it a, quote, great frustration for employers. Well, I'm sorry, Stuart, that trans people are a frustration to you and their demands. I mean, I just think it's shocking and quite oppressive. But and even at my own institution, like a kind of an associate professor said that it was inequitable that trans people should be given leave when non-trans people don't. And I think that really misunderstands equity, and that the union movement is actually fighting for equitable access to leave. Everyone should have sick leave, whether you're casual or whether you're trans. You know, you shouldn't have to draw down your sick leave. Being transgender is not a sickness, by the way. Despite that kickback, though, I think I've been pleasantly surprised that we haven't seen a huge kickback from the media, and those right-wing talking points have not been widely circulated by the right-wing press or by the Liberal Party or anyone else, partly because of some of the wins I think we've been talking about before and just that growing confidence of the trans and the LGBT movement. For that reason, there's kind of been quite a bit of confidence to say to kind of back the NTU on this claim. Now, what's exciting, I guess, is that the University of Sydney has conceded to 30 days of leave. They're saying that this should be one-off leave rather than an annualised form of leave, whereas the union is just saying that, you know, the reality of transition is that it's not a one-time thing. I mean, it's kind of an oppressive idea, I guess, to say that, you know, trans people pop in male and pop out female after a little surgery or whatever it might be. I mean, that's not really how it works. It's an ongoing process. You might change over years. Even people who undergo a medical route might choose to get facial feminization, or they might choose to get top surgery, or they might choose to get this or that. And for a lot of people, they might choose to identify differently over the years, and this can be an ongoing kind of negotiation. So I think it does perpetuate a bit of a transphobic idea or a bit of a reductive idea of what it is to be trans. So the union is just sticking to its guns, and there's been a bit of a campaign. I mean, it has been difficult during the pandemic, I won't lie, but even just kind of speaking to colleagues, going to kind of the Pride Network meetings, gathering petitions and support from students and staff to say that, you know, we've now got over 200 people saying we back the NTEU's claim, we want to see gender transition leave to be annualised every single year, just as an upper limit. So I think I'm quite hopeful that we can kind of really continue this movement and get a really rock solid clause at University of Sydney. But a lot of what I'm excited about is also, you know, we're pushing for a national forum to speak about this and how important gender transition leave is across the whole sector. And also for this to be consolidated as a bit of a working class demand that can be pushed in every sector. The ASU has kind of put up a model clause, which is really, really great to see. The financial sectors union has actually had a win at Westpac for 6 weeks of leave and you know, I think it's a growing conversation, but I'm really hopeful that this can be an example where we can get together and fight. And just to speak a little bit about why it's not just about trans people, I mean, I think in the attacks against this trans leave, they haven't stopped at trans leave as being an element of inequality. They've spoken about domestic violence leave. They've talked about menstrual and menopausal leave. I mean, for the right wing, they want to see these kinds of issues of equity, of challenging oppression within the workplace, they want to see that flattened into a kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. And I think, you know, for all of us, we need to unite and fight about challenging inequalities in the workplace, challenging transphobic ideas in the workplace, and fighting together against the bosses who are literally right now cutting jobs and pushing forward a pretty brutal agenda, the University of Sydney and across the sector, that we're going to need to fight really hard to fight back. And I think, you know, taking a principled stand on transphobia, on sexism, on racism is an absolutely necessary part of pushing back against the boss's agenda altogether, protecting jobs and protecting, I guess, education.
I couldn't put it better myself, and that's a fantastic note on which to finish. So I'd like to thank you, Danny, for your time and for your insights. It's been really valuable.
Yeah, thanks so much, David. It's been great.